Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to hear an interview with the legendary JL. Welcome to my podcast, JL. Well, how are you today?
Thank you, Brian. I'm doing
quite
well.
Good to see you. Yeah, you're looking good.
Thank you.
JL is probably the world's best known authority for Scandinavian languages.
But
yeah,
and
a fan, yes. Well, quite knowledgeable. Mm-hmm. Danish practically being a mother tongue. Mm-hmm. You know somebody close to you who's a native speaker. Mm-hmm. Swedish also. I've heard you speak Swedish. Mm-hmm. And I know you go skiing in Norway.
I go to Norway every year, except for COVID.
Yeah, COVID's really messed up our holidays.
And then in the summers we go hiking in Norway, so it's been really hard.
All parts of Norway?
Everything. Well, we always ski about 2 hours north of Lillehammer.
Uh-huh.
But actually the long distance ski route there is called the Peer Gynt route.
Oh, nice. Yes. Oh. We're listening to Peer Gynt, by the way. Sibelius, I think, is it, or is it Greek?
Greek.
Uh-huh, okay.
And then, for hiking, we prefer, above the Arctic Circle, we prefer the areas Narvik.
I was in the Arctic Circle. I did a fact-finding mission on nuclear waste in across the border in Russia, Murmansk. Uh-huh. We took a helicopter there with the European Parliament and the Norwegian Parliament, and when we got back, we were told to immediately get rid of our shoes. And we thought, well, why didn't you tell us before? Those were expensive shoes, and I had to buy really, really expensive crap shoes.
Oh, my goodness.
Basically what is, I mean, that town is like an Alaskan bus stop. Uh-huh. You know, and there are more people on the streets at 3 o'clock in the morning than at 3 in the afternoon. Most of them Russian and drunk.
Well, I would say our north of the Arctic Circle experiences are involved less people.
Uh-huh.
There are.
But you don't eat bear meat or reindeer.
I don't eat any, but I do gather the multa berries and blueberries.
And the mushrooms?
No, I don't touch mushrooms unless I have a...
Yeah, they're probably radioactive up there.
Yeah, but yeah, actually up there they can be radioactive, but no, I don't pick mushrooms unless I'm with an expert.
Okay.
Because I've been in too many different... The only place, that's not true, the only place I pick mushrooms...
Is Lithuania?
Is Lithuania.
Yeah.
Because they have so many of the cantharels.
Yeah.
And they have a very, very distinctive...
At the local Polish shop too, they sell wonderful organic pickles, mushrooms... Mm-hmm. They make their own kefir, and it's like 1/4 the price of supermarket prices. Mm. The only thing, it has traveled by truck from Poland, but that's the extent of it. Otherwise, and some of them even are Poles in Germany who plant, or here in Brussels they have their own collectives where they grow mushrooms and things like and pickles.
Well, these mushrooms are grown in the forests of Lithuania and south of Vilnius, towards the Belarus border. Very uh-huh. beautiful area.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Because you speak Lithuanian now.
Yes, I do.
Wow. And soon you'll be adding French.
My biggest party trick is speaking Swedish. Excuse me, speaking Danish. Because if I'm among Swedes,
They ask
me to pronounce certain Danish words, and then they all fall over themselves laughing.
They do, don't
it's,
they?
It's really quite a hit.
Are you ready to break your fast?
That's amazing.
These are lacto-fermented homemade dill pickles, Polish, planted from seed on my balcony. And the carrots are store-bought, but in curry. And the cauliflower also in curry.
That's interesting, because my carrots are in curry, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't put the cauliflower in with them. That's a good idea.
In fact,
God, they're good.
I think it was Crystal who'd said that her mom bought, it was done with vinegar, not with that fermentation, but with all kinds of different vegetables, and she called it potpourri. But with asparagus and cauliflower and radishes. Radishes get all mucky.
That's what my mother made with them. It was cauliflower, celery, American celery. Carrots, and basically it was like an oil and vinegar. Uh-huh. And she just kept that in the fridge. It was so good. It was just always, it was like instant salad. It was so good.
Now, my German grandfather made sauerkraut in the basement, and we as kids thought that was really gross and old-worldly. And now here I am, I'm a grandfather, making gross sauerkraut in the kitchen.
I'm married to someone who doesn't believe in sauerkraut, so I have to get my fix when I'm in Lithuania. Lithuanians have very good sauerkraut.
And Poles as well.
Mm. When I was growing up, I had a friend who was Croatian American, and her father made sauerkraut, and the background flavor was white wine and garlic. It was just like a different.
And kimchi, do you add chili?
I have to do my own kimchi because lots of chili, but because most kimchi spice mixes have fish in them. You can pretty much guess, you know, by reading what else you can put in it. So you mix it.
I heard that they even use fish oil in wine. There are vegan wines because they don't use fish oil. Who would have thunk?
Mass-produced beer, like Heineken or anything, the really big beers, is filtered through fish bladders. So you have to go for smaller, and first of all, my favorite beer in the world is Lithuanian unpasteurized beer. And so, of course, that's not filtered at all. But apparently the Czechs also do unpasteurized beer. And there are all kinds of very healthy enzymes in unpasteurized beer. I am a firm believer in beer that can't travel. I really like unpasteurized draft beer. It's pretty amazing.
Do you know about the Belgian Beer Project?
No.
It's a new local organic brewery in Molenbeek.
Okay.
And they produce all kinds of local beers. La Grosse Berthe.
Okay.
Which is it's a strong beer, and the idea is that it was Berta came from Berlin and came to Brussels and loved it, and so it's the Grosse Berthe. They also make another one called they have a whole range of beers.
Because the Grosse Berthe, isn't that the name of the really famous canon in the First World War?
It is. Uh-huh. It's also the name of a famous prostitute.
So if I'd seen that, I just thought I would have made the association with the canon.
When I first came to Brussels, the Greens were not yet a proper political movement. They were a political party. They were also parlamentarische Bewegung. And there was a dedicated group of interpreters who were prepared to work for them for free. Mm-hmm. And I worked for them once. They had a big hearing. It was organized on the premises of a hotel. I think Sheraton or Conrad, some big hotel. Mm-hmm. And it was a hearing on the working rights of sex workers. Mm-hmm. And the part I remember the most, aside from the fact that there were women breastfeeding everywhere, which I had never seen before in public, but there were also two trans sex workers who stepped into the middle of the stage in order to do a practical demonstration of how to deal with recalcitrant Johns who don't want to wear a condom. La Grosse Berthe, who was this big black trans, held a banana in her hand, and her colleague, who was also quite large, inserted the banana in her mouth, and when the banana exited, the banana was peeled and had a condom on it.
I'm impressed.
Everybody was impressed. There was a silence. But one of the high moments in my interpreting career.
Have you ever gone to the street theater festival in Chassepierre?
No.
Oh, it's highly recommended. This year probably not because it's going to be tiny because of restrictions, but next year. It's the same weekend of August every year. And there's all kinds of, it can be music, it can be mime, any kind of street theater. And one of the things they were doing were two gigantic slinkies. Two people had dressed up as gigantic slinkies.
Wow.
And they were doing this really very expressive, they were actually communicating as slinkies, but they were so good at it, you really were communicating with them.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, one of them ate, as if you can picture a slinky going down,
I can.
Ate a child. a random child that was there, and everyone just stood there absolutely silent.
And what did the child do?
30 seconds later, the child emerged just laughing hysterically, as if it had had just the best experience ever in its life. But for that, it was really interesting. For that 30 seconds, everyone was, how can you do that? And then there were these enormously tall Austrians on stilts, and they were people from another planet. That's why they were so tall, but their stilts were hidden in their pants, so they were dressed sort of in formal tuxes, but they were just enormously tall because they were very skilled stilt walkers. And they were trying to redistribute everything in the crowd. Like, they would take people's purses and give them to other purses, you know, things like that. And it was just ha ha ha. And then they walked up to a woman who had really beautiful, thick, long hair, and they plucked a piece of hair off her head. And then they walked up to a bald gentleman, and the one bent all the way over and licked the top of his head and pasted the hair on top of it. And everyone was just sort of standing there for a second, and luckily both of them
took it
extremely well.
Yeah.
But it's really fascinating because there are all kinds of levels of theater going on there. Unexpected things going on. A bunch of women dressed up in rubber boots, and they did a invented folk dance of what they called Wallonian peasants. And it was a very complicated dance, but it involved a lot of slapping on the rubber boot. It was, it's just all kinds of stuff. It's amazing.
When I was a young boy, I went to the Kiwanis Club. My dad and grandfather dragged us there every year, and it was for a fish smelt evening, you know. The evening was long, but the entertainment that year was a clown who did magic tricks. Mm-hmm. And before the dinner started, the clown came up to my grandfather, apparently, and asked me to stand up on my chair and congratulated me on knowing how to wear a suit and tie, jacket as a little boy, which I hated. And I didn't think much about it. And then we ate, and then the performance started, and the clown started making things disappear and appear out of his hat and stuff. And then all of a sudden, he pulled an egg out of his ear. And then went like that, and it disappeared. And he said, Where did it go? And then he came to our table, made me stand on top of the table, and it was in my sock. He had planted it in my sock without me realizing it.
You'd sat there for like half an hour.
I had no idea there was an egg in my sock. Or else he had it up his sleeve and produced it there. That's the only possible explanation. And apparently my mouth was about as wide as a well, just in utter amazement in front of the audience who were burst out laughing.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Memories, magician.
Magician.
When I was a boy, I wanted to be a ventriloquist. Well, first a magician, then a ventriloquist. I actually had a dummy, and I realized that's what I've become. The dummy moves his mouth, and I'm doing the talking, but nobody sees me.
Very good.
Yeah. So, do you want to tell us about your veganism? Is it militant?
It's very mild because actually I have the same relationship with eggs and dairy products as I do with alcohol. In other words, I go weeks
without, and then you really enjoy it.
And then I have some, and then I keep track of it.
Yeah.
I have a journal, and so there was. Last weekend there was eggs in the cake I baked.
Yeah.
And tonight I'm going out with Lisa, and there will be, I think, homemade mozzarella in the first course.
Oh, wow.
So I save it for.
Her partner is a vegan now.
It's no dairy.
Oh, just no dairy.
Yeah.
I thought it was also vegan because he's for anti. Something.
Oh no! Well, maybe you could be right.
And Rowena's husband has MS.
Yeah.
He's also gone vegan because they've heard that's good for multiple sclerosis.
I know, it's good. I've heard it's really good for cancer, if someone gets cancer.
Yeah.
Because there's less inflammation in the body.
And you know, doctors are calling Alzheimer's, many doctors, type 3 diabetes. They're putting their Alzheimer's patients on longer fasts under medical supervision. And it just, their condition improves.
That's really interesting.
In fact, fasting was used as a drug-free treatment for epileptic children in the 20s. But then Big Pharma got into the picture and you can't make any money by not eating, so.
No.
And the whole myth about breakfast being the most important meal of the day, you know where that comes from?
I don't know.
Dr. Kellogg.
I know.
He was...
I know he was.
He actually was a medical doctor in the 1870s when that didn't mean much. It was lots of quackery. But since he had... and he was of the strong belief that it is important to eat food that is as bland as possible so as not to whet the sexual appetite. Bad, very bad. Therefore, this explains cornflakes and oatmeal.
And graham crackers.
Yeah, graham crackers. and he wrote in a medical journal, and since it got republished and spread, that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. You don't want your metabolism to slow down. And it caught on and has been repeated as gospel almost ever since in medical schools.
I'll have to send you a podcast that explains the origin of the, what's it called, MSG? Is that the spice?
Yeah, yeah.
Syndrome.
Monosodium glutamate.
It doesn't, that syndrome doesn't exist. Someone wrote an article on a bed.
No.
And it got published. And it's just been republished and republished.
But it does give some people headaches.
It can, maybe it does, but it's...
Yeah. It imitates a neurotransmitter in the brain that I think it messes up all the other neurotransmitters. You know?
But apparently the research that assumption is based is a joke by this, and someone finally tracked the...
A very, very interesting, probably the best podcast on longevity and healthy living is Dr. Mark Hyman. He's a former doctor he worked as a surgeon in the emergency room, and like they used to brag about not needing sleep, going for 3 days and still operating, and you know, sleeping's for sissies, until the day when he couldn't get out of bed, couldn't open his eyes, and he was supposed to be driving across the country to his relatives, and he became more and more interested in he's now a naturopathic doctor, and he advises patients. He's got a fantastic book, as well, too. Well, it's called Pharmacy Online with an F, Dr. Mark Hyman. It's got hundreds of interviews with all the biohackers in the world. Dr. Jason Fung, who is a Canadian nephrologist, who he studied kidney failure, but he realized most of his patients... the kidney failure was a secondary phenomenon compared to other morbidities they had, such as diabetes, cancer, or being incredibly obese. And they had zero quality of life, zero quality of sleep, and they were all dying like flies. He said that wasn't much fun. So he started looking into the science of fasting. In all the religious practices, there's some equivalent of fasting. Not because they wanted the believers to suffer, but because they knew that it was good. You know, Hippocrates is the father of modern medicine. He said, let thy food be thy medicine. Benjamin Franklin said, the two best medicines are sleep and a good fast. Ancient practices that we've lost sight of. We have basically the same DNA as cavemen, but we don't live like cavemen.
No.
We don't. Cavemen didn't stay up on their iPads and watch Netflix.
No.
And they were up at dawn. I went to a local, there's a new African cafe near where we live, and there's this Belgian who lived for 6 years in Burkina Faso. So in Burkina Faso, everybody's in bed at 9 o'clock and they wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and do heavy work in the fields before it gets too hot. And then during the day they just mull about, maybe have a little nap or eat something, you know. Entirely different way of life.
Well, we used to go to sleep in several segments in the north, I mean, obviously in Burkina Faso, you're closer to the equator, so you can have a more balanced relationship.
But
people who've lived in Northern Europe have very often gone to bed at 8 p.m.
Yeah.
And then you get up again, and in places like London, people went to the coffee house in the middle of the night. Apparently there was something called the first and second sleep, and in between, that's when you had sex with your partner, or that's when you, conducted business. There was all kinds of...
Your coffee was considered politically explosive, because that's where people met together and plotted against the powers that be.
And they were drunk, right, and they were... But that was... because it was going to be dark from... You know, in the wintertime, it was going to be dark from 6 p.m.
That's right.
Until 8 a.m. the next day. So it was all, we got a lot more sleep.
And you know how the Inuits stay healthy, even though the fact they eat zero vegetables or fruit?
Well, they eat the innards.
And it's got everything you need.
Yeah.
And we stopped. I mean, liver is good if it's not too toxic. Yeah. But liver can be very toxic if it's industrial.
If you know where it's from.
Yeah. I remember when I was a kid being grossed out that the traditional Alsatian sauerkraut, the choucroute, had lung meat in it, intestines, and liver. I was totally grossed out by that.
My best moment was in Poland in the late 80s when there was basically no food. I was visiting a friend, and they basically ran out of food. And so you go to a restaurant and they served you because... There was no choice. They just put something warm in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And one time I got to the bottom of the bowl of soup. It was intestines. And so they were these little fingers kind of waving at me at the bottom.
Yummy.
It was quite good. I have to say, for a country that had run out of food, they did the best.
In Poland, they had, during the communist days, they had what they called... I can't remember offhand what they're called, but basically almost free vegetarian places to eat, open 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the poor people in the down and out
get their nourishment.
The milk bars. Mechny bar, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what they're called.
In Lithuania, they're called penis bars.
They call what? Penis bar?
Penis bars.
Why?
Because that's the milk is penis.
Oh my God.
That's great.
That reminds me of a joke, but some of the
But they're not as widespread. I think they're just leftover from. They're probably leftovers from the '20s when Poland was still part of Poland.
In communist Poland, pub grub was crackers with lard spread on top.
I have to say, I had wonderful memories of the milk bars in Poland.
Yeah.
Because. They had macaroni and cheese, they had borscht, they had kefir. It was wonderful.
The one in Krakow that I went to, Andy Gillies at the time, he was teaching in Krakow, and I helped with the summer workshops several weeks, which was really good for my Polish, and trying to demonstrate how to do consecutive to them. You know, most of them are now on staff here, the students. One of them was the former head of the Polish booth, and now I don't know what she's doing. Anyway, Andrew Giddies in those days was vegetarian. I don't think he's anymore, but we went to, it was called the Pink Elephant, Ruzovi Swan. And we went there almost every other day. And the Polish sometimes complained about having to eat vegetarian, but they put up with it because he was the professor, you know. And then afterwards they'd go get a ham sandwich or whatever.
Well, in Lithuania, they fast before Easter, but they also fast before Christmas.
They do.
And so quite a lot of traditional foods
that Christmas.
You don't have any meat in them.
Well, in Poland, you have to eat 12 dishes vegetarian on Christmas Eve. Although in Poland, when there was no food, they would sometimes call the salt and pepper as ingredients, you know, because they didn't have enough, you know. But one of them is typically carp. And they kept the carp in the markets in terrible conditions. You know, the carp is dying of starvation, of oxygen shortage, and now they're treating them more.
Yes, I was in the petitions committee. There was a petition for
against the carp.
Better treatment of carp.
Yeah.
So, yes, the parliament is on it. We're on the case.
Yeah. And do you know Yarek? from the Polish booth.
Uh-huh.
David Walker and I met him several times before, well before Poland ever joined. Uh-huh. He was the young, clever Western, Westernized interpreter working for the Polish Sejm, and all of his colleagues were like ancient battle axes who did Soviet-style three-word in a row, word-for-word translations. Today it is very. Сегодня, no. Dzisiaj jest очень bardzo. And it was just painful. And then he would do a proper consecutive, you know, 10 minutes in a row.
Uh-huh.
It was like two worlds colliding, you know, coexisting but colliding.
Yeah.
Alexei and I were on the first commercial flight to Albania after the dictatorship.
Okay.
And that was an education, believe you me. When we arrived, there was an old man chasing sheep off the runway so that the Boeing wouldn't run them over.
That was when my brother, he commanded a couple of different Navy bases, and on one of them, the big thing was chasing the deer off the landing strip. And then in New Orleans, it was keeping the feral pigs who had escaped because of Katrina.
Yeah.
And then they had all said to one another, let's go to the Navy base. And they went and the...
there's food there.
And the Navy, well, because they have a... because it's an air and sea base, they had a big crash zone around it for the airplanes, and so that was a swamp. And so the pigs, during Katrina, just left and reestablished themselves in the swamp.
Yeah.
And so he had the pleasure of chasing them around all the time and assigning people to chase pigs because, first of all, they just got in the way of the planes.
Yeah.
They were too smart, the alligators. Couldn't eat them because they thought the alligators would keep them down, but they didn't.
Yeah,
they were devoted to digging up the runways. So he had this feral pig issue of all the. I mean, not only was he rebuilding the base after Katrina and making it floodproof, but he was just hoping the pigs didn't destroy it.
Did you see that viral video that I saw on the BBC? It was a mother who saw her tiny daughter. Uh-huh. Getting grabbed by a bear over the garden fence, and she went up and she fought the bear. She slapped him in the head, hit him in the head, kicked him, and grabbed her daughter back and went to the house.
Uh-huh.
That was just a couple of months ago. It was one of the most viral videos ever.
Oh, that's really interesting. I know someone who rescued. I've heard of someone who rescued a child from a bear. I think it was Yellowstone. Because the bear went to grab their child, and the only thing they had, this was in the old days, was a 35mm camera, and it was in a leather case on a long strap, you know?
Yeah.
And she swung it.
I've used this as a weapon.
She swung it and landed a shot right on the snout. And it was the bear was so perplexed.
Yeah.
Because it's heavy, those cameras were heavy.
Yeah.
That it dropped the child.
Did it break the lens?
I don't know, but it dropped the child.
Yeah.
Yeah, it dropped the child, so that was...
Well, my brother, who's now passed away, we went to visit him, and his partner had a wood cabin in, not Yellowstone, but Northern California, what was it? Another one of the
reserves.
Yosemite. Yeah. And they were the few, during their lifetime they could keep it, but then it was no longer ownership rights applied.
Yeah.
But we were able to go stay there in the middle, and surrounded by bears, and all the garbage was bear-free, you know, protected.
Mm-hmm.
And he told a story about neighbors that said there was a 2 or 3 year old girl who sat down on a stone in front of her cabin, and a bear sat down next to her, on the stone next to her, and she had lined up M&Ms, and she ate one, and then she gave one to the bear. And she ate one, and she ate one to the bear, and she ate one. And when it came to the last one, she took it, and the bear grabbed it, and it tore her hand off.
Do you remember when Trump was talking about that particular park?
Yeah.
And called it the Yosemite Park.
Oh, really?
Well, I was reading about that. I didn't hear it. I was reading about it in the newspaper, and so I was reading this aloud to myself. And so I ended up saying, Yosemite. And my dog came running, and that's how I found out he identified as Jewish. I didn't know that until he came running up to me.
That's so funny.
Yeah, it was very.
I could have been Jewish in a previous life.
Oh, I think I haven't.
Do you know Zidani?
Who?
Zidani. She's a stand-up, a one-woman show here in Belgium. She's world famous in Francophone.
No.
We've gone traveling with them to Italy and to Israel, and people walk up to her at the airport and saying, "Mais vous êtes Zidani, mais vous êtes Navier." And her Israeli partner, who's now got Belgian nationality, she brags about her all the time. And Zidani likes to be, she likes to be quiet. She's a public person on stage, but off stage, she's not really that extroverted. Mm-hmm. And she's funny as hell.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite scenes is, she plays a school teacher. She was a former school teacher. She taught Protestant ethics in the Belgian school system, even though her father was Algerian and her mother was a Belgian Catholic Francophone. And she, being neither Muslim or Catholic, decided to go for Protestantism. She thought it was, you know, Calvinism was improved Catholicism. And, she has a sketch where she's a school teacher and she said, Silence! Non, Rachid, combien de fois je dois te dire, Jésus n'était pas un musulman. Écoute bien, Jésus était un juif, catholique, non, qui s'est converti au catholicisme. Un juif palestinien qui s'est converti. And I used to tell that joke in Krakow and people didn't like it. Well, you know, it was a hippie on top of it, you know. He defied authority. But when John Paul II said that the Iraq War was immoral, the Poles chose to listen to Ronald Reagan instead of, what was it, George W. then?
What did they say? The Iraq War.
Yeah, the...
Oh,
John Paul, the Pope too, he said it was immoral.
Okay.
Nobody listened. Okay, Jean, well, I'm going to wrap it up here on this. Is there something you'd like to add?
I thought you were going to ask me when I started fasting.
Okay, yeah. When did you start fasting?
Well, in the spring of 2019, and I think I tried it the same way you did, which was I started not having dinner.
Yeah.
And I could only do it during the week when I was working.
Yeah.
Because it's really antisocial to do that with a partner.
Yeah.
So I just...
And I didn't want the brain fog at work.
Right.
Because when you adapt, you don't get that razor sharp thought. That takes about 6 weeks adjustment.
Well, I don't know. But I just found myself really not happy in the evening. I really felt like I missed something.
Yeah.
And so then that summer of 2019, I decided, no, I'm going to start the other way around. I'm going to have dinner, but I'm going to try to finish early, not have a late dinner.
That's
because
right.
Especially in the summertime.
It's much easier.
It's easy to extend dinner, you know, until 10 o'clock at night if you're just sitting around. So I decided, no, just to stop eating, even if I wasn't done, just stop.
Yeah.
And then just see how far I could go. And maybe because I did it during the summer when I was doing a lot of work around the house, or maybe because it was just very busy. Maybe because I wasn't at work. By the time I got back to work in the autumn, I was fine.
Yeah.
I could easily go to one or two in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And not feel like...
Well, what?
I don't think I would have had a happy adjustment if I had trained myself to do that at work. But I had a really easy adjustment. And then the reason I did this was I noticed that a lot of people on both sides of my family developed blood sugar issues post-menopause.
Yeah.
And since I had arrived at that happy stage and was done with all that teenage nonsense, I thought, well, that's like the only thing I can do because I already exercise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I couldn't think of any other...
I thought I was fit too.
...practical thing to do that would be... And then, of course, as so many things, I read an article in the New York Times. I've been reading the New York Times since I was 15, so a lot of conversations start with me. I read this article in the New York Times, and it was true. And
it was about fasting.
It was about fasting.
Have you heard of Jean Stevens?
No.
She's also fascinating. I'm going to be on her podcast in February.
Okay.
She wrote, her most recent book is called Fast, Feast, Repeat.
Mm-hmm.
Without any advertising except mm-hmm. for her followers, it went to the top 10 New mm-hmm. York Times bestsellers list.
Okay.
She's a retired school teacher.
Maybe it was a review of her book or something. I don't know, but it was definitely.
Well, she's got followers all around the world.
Yeah. But
millions.
Mm-hmm.
She interviews people from India, from Barbados.
Mm-hmm.
She's got an infectious laughter.
Mm-hmm.
She has this hour-long podcast called Intermittent Fasting Stories, where mm-hmm. most people have totally transformed their lives.
Mm-hmm.
People have lost between 25 and 125 kilos.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are reversing their type 2 diabetes,
mm-hmm.
which people say is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Reversing cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I used to have, my upper back was a whole constellation of moles, and they're
really?
All gone. They're all gone.
Oh, that would be so nice.
I got my singing voice back.
Mm-hmm.
I started to have a croaky old man's voice.
Mm-hmm.
I got my singing voice back.
Wow.
What's
your typical, because my typical fast
I was
is between 16 and 18 hours.
Yeah.
That's my typical fast.
I occasionally do one meal a day, like Elaine.
Okay. I worked with Elaine this morning.
Yeah. She's been into longevity forever.
Yeah.
Not just, she was doing calorie restriction for a long
uh-huh.
time. That's just plain miserable. You're hungry
yeah.
all the time.
Yeah.
She's done it. She's done all kinds of stuff.
Uh-huh.
She's a good source. I interviewed her on the podcast.
Okay.
Karen Olson.
Karen Fry. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yes, of course. I knew that.
And
I ran into
who else?
Her when she was breaking.
Annabelle's done a little bit, but
uh-huh.
she finds it hard with her partner. So.
Okay.
And she was less than impressed with the results. She didn't see the results fast enough, but
mm-hmm.
she has lost weight.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly body composition. You don't always lose weight because muscle weighs more than.
Yeah, I'm more muscular.
Yeah. I lost 30 kilos in 3 years.
Wow.
The first 6 months, just doing it 4 times a day,
huh.
4 days a week, I lost 6 kilos.
Uh-huh.
Then in the following year, I lost another 4, and I thought I was done.
Yeah.
I was at that level for about 2 years.
Yeah.
And then the confinement hit,
mm-hmm.
and I started to do yoga.
Mm-hmm.
I started to nerd out on the science of
mm-hmm.
getting old,
mm-hmm.
autophagy,
mm-hmm.
the Nobel Prize of 2016,
mm-hmm.
the Japanese scientist, worth looking up.
Mm-hmm.
David Asprey, the father of biohacking,
mm-hmm.
he as a kid, he had Lyme disease,
mm-hmm.
he was obese, he had
mm-hmm.
all kinds of infections,
mm-hmm.
colds, just always sick.
Mm-hmm.
As a young man, he became very rich with a startup,
mm-hmm.
but he was still miserable, so he
mm-hmm.
decided to throw all of his money on self-experimentation, going to
mm-hmm.
the experts saying, what should I try next?
Mm-hmm.
And he's now a very, very healthy, I think he's about 45 years old,
mm-hmm.
that's not that old,
mm-hmm.
but he's very thin,
mm-hmm.
he's got these perky eyes, he has a YouTube channel,
mm-hmm.
and he's written many books as well. His most recent one is Fast This Way, but he does much more than fasting. He
mm-hmm.
does crazy shit like applying electrical stimulation to his brain. He's out there, he's taking really smart drugs,
mm-hmm.
you know. I think that's, but he says, but there's no ethical problem because it's my body.
That's true, it's his body.
And he imports even like stuff that he gets in the US, he lives in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in theory illegal, but he orders it from China and
mm-hmm.
places like that. He's got no qualms. And he claims he's going to live to be 180.
Okay.
So far, so good.
Yeah.
Anyway, right.
Okay.
I'm off to the gym, I
yes.
think.
Very good.
That's a fitting end.
Yes.
Well, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Here, this is your phone.
This is my phone.
This is my crazy Chinese phone. I love my phone.
Huawei.
Yeah. You know what these cost? 150 euros.
Yeah. Not very good for privacy, though.
No, but yeah.
JL.
I know, but I have an extra like virus thing on it. Oh no, I even asked my brother when I went home, when my brother was still two-star admiral.
Well,
I went home after.
Put your iOS background information in Lithuanian or Danish.
Mm-hmm.
Preferably Lithuanian, because that'll be more hard to crack.
Yeah. Oh, it's nice. That was really interesting.
And all my passwords have three different scripts: Arabic, Russian, and Greek.
I have complicated passwords. I make sure, big, smaller, random.
Well, when they get the supercomputers, they're going to be cracked. In fact, when I have Fastmail. It does what Signal does for your privacy, but your iCloud, your pictures, your contact list, your notes, and your files, and it costs $6.99 a month, but that's less than what I